Awesome to welcome Samford head basketball coach Matt Wise to the Basketball Podcast. Coach Wise enters the 2025-26 season as the head women's basketball coach at Samford University, continuing to build on a coaching career defined by player development, tactical innovation, and program elevation. After being officially introduced as the new head coach in April 2025, Wise took the reins following 2 seasons as an assistant coach with the Samford Bulldogs, where he was deeply involved in all aspects of the program. Prior to his time at Samford, Wise served as the director of video and creative content for Alabama women's basketball team during the 2021-22 season. His coaching journey also includes extensive experience on the men's side, with assistant coaching roles at East Tennessee State, Little Rock, and 2 separate stints at the University of Wyoming. At Wyoming, he helped guide the Cowboys to a Mountain West tournament title and an NCAA tournament berth in 2015, contributing to the development of NBA forward Larry Nance Jr. Wise began his coaching career as a graduate assistant at the University of Florida, where he supported the Gators during back-to-back Elite Eight appearances. A former 4-year letter winner at Transylvania University, he led the Pioneers to a 2009 NCAA Division III tournament appearance and earned his master's degree in sport management. Do you know which lineups and player combinations are the most productive? Hoopsalytics has the most comprehensive lineup analysis system available. Coaches can see how each group performs offensively or defensively or excels in special situations. For example, if you need to force a late game turnover, you can see which group has the best defensive turnover percentage or see which 4 athletes work best with your star player. And you can do the same team-based analysis for groups of 2 or 3 players as well. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com today to learn more. Matt, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Appreciate you having me.
Man, our history goes back way long ago. Thank you to Larry Shiat and the Florida Clinic and everything that goes with that. And I got to know you and your family a little bit through that. But most importantly now, new head coach at Samford. How does that feel? And what are you looking forward to?
It feels good. It feels really good when you haven't lost the game yet. But I think it's something that I've wanted for such a long time. I grew up in it. It's been a part of my life for such a long time. I think it's the ability to set the message and the agenda, to have a vision and try to cast the ship in that direction. Even if we're off course, just keep moving to that destination. That, to me, is the most exciting piece of it from this chair.
It's exciting. We're going to dive into that a little bit, but just to give a little context to what's beautiful is like your career is a little bit non-traditional in some sense too, that you've been in the men's game, you've been in the women's game. And I'm imagining somewhat, it's like you took opportunities that were good for you and you didn't necessarily know what the end result was going to be, but you knew the goal was to be a head coach.
Yeah. Even when I set out on the initial journey to go coach basketball, I didn't care high school, college, men, women, pro. It did not matter to me. I put out feelers everywhere, and it just happened for very fortunate reasons. It started as a grad assistant for Billy Donovan, and so that just set off the path on the men's college side. And then in the midst of COVID, I was on back-to-back staffs that were let go. So it was a total, okay, let's catch our breath. Let's reset from the rat race of trying to climb the ladder on the men's side and focus more on, okay, what do I value? What do I care about? How am I impacting people's lives? And the way that it happened, and I've told the story before, but I do think it's wild how it happened that as I'm looking for different opportunities, I started to talk to different people about the possibility of switching to the women's side. And I ended up getting a call from someone, from Cam Neubauer, who was at Florida at the time, and said, hey, Christy Curry at Alabama is really good people. You're going to go take their video job. And he just said, you're going to take it. He was like, I know you want to be an assistant. I know you've earned this stuff, but just take a step back, go work for her because she's really good people. So I go there, and a year after working for her, and sure enough, unbelievable people at Alabama, she comes into my office and goes, hey, you're going to go take an assistant job for Carly Coons at Samford. They're really good people. Like the exact same thing. Not what do you think of this? Hey, maybe an opportunity. Like you're just going to do this. And okay. And did I think that 3 years later, it would wind up with me moving offices down the hall? No, But man, what a blessed opportunity. Holy cow.
And again, it highlights again, just do your job, be ready, and you never know what's going to come your way. And Coach Curry's done this podcast. She's tremendous and obviously had some of the best basketball going on in Alabama history, started your time there and through last year. So a great program to be a part of. Talk to us then. First steps at Samford. They announce you. I watched the press conference. They hand you that nice jersey with your name on the back. And then what are the next steps for a first-year new head coach?
We got done. We met as a staff about some things immediately after taking all the pictures and doing all the craziness. And we worked through lunch, and it was around, I don't know, 3:30, 4 o'clock. We finally broke for lunch. And so I took the staff out for lunch. In the time of us being at lunch, we found out that the whole team wanted to go in the portal. Now, they were super supportive of me getting it. I think they got really spooked and freaked out by the transition. It all happened fast. It happened in 48 hours. It was chaos. So no ill will to any of them. They were just scared. And unknown is scary, right? Like we freak out at the unknown. It's why we try to train so hard at being comfortable in the unknown. And so I end up on a FaceTime with one of our starters and her parents for about 2 hours. And I'm laying out for them the same thing I told the administration here, the same thing I told the staff, the same thing I've been talking about at the dinner table with my parents for 35, 36 years is this is the vision. This is how I see it going. This is the why. This is the how. This is what we do. This is what we're about. These are the values, all of it. And I lay it out. And by the end of the conversation, the dad goes, "Matt, you need to have this conversation with every single family on the team." So we end up lining up 13 Zooms between all the returners and the committed kids we had coming in. The next day, this is Easter Saturday. I'd gotten the job at Friday of Easter weekend at noon, and this is Easter Saturday. And we had lined up 13 straight Zooms every hour on the hour with 5 minute bathroom breaks. And it's me for 55 minutes. And the staff's on there, but these parents and these players, they wanted to hear what will be the same, what will be different, what's the vision, how is this going to work, how do you see me? Everybody has a little bit of selfishness to them of how's it going to go for me? And they needed to hear that. They need to hear that I valued them, yes, as a person, but they knew that because we had a very strong relationship. But they needed to know I valued them as a basketball player and how were we going to win games using them. And so we just crank it out. And at the end of the 13, over the next couple of days, we ended up with 11 of the 13 recommitted. The two that left both ended up transferring up with significant dollar amounts included, which I was thrilled for them. Told them every step along the way, walked them through what it looks like if they come back, what it looks like if they leave, how could I help them? Because nobody chose, as far as the players, for this to happen. But that was the chaos of the first 48 hours. It was wild. And then from there, it was hit the ground running hard and fast.
Incredible perspective to be able to give us, and thanks for sharing that. And let's maybe go with what you said there. What was something that you're telling the players that is going to stay the same? Because again, you were part of shaping this program to a certain extent as an assistant coach.
The biggest thing that was going to stay the same, and I probably fall short every single day of Carly's capability to show love and empathy. I think it's one of my superpowers. She had it tenfold. She's one of the most loving relationship people ever, to the point where the players are coming to hang in her office every day. We go as a staff to lunch with the players in the cafeteria, and I get it. Trust me, I get it. Every single coach, every single staff, they sell it in recruiting. They talk about it when they're in public. We're a family. This is a family. This is a sisterhood. We're about love. I get it. I'm telling you that Carly had this program times a billion of all that. And so that was the biggest thing. They wanted to hear that it wasn't going to become transactional, which is never how I've operated, but they wanted to hear that part was going to stay the same.
And just for people's reference, Carly left to go to Maryland as an assistant coach. And again, not uncommon nowadays for mid, low major head coaches to jump to be power four assistant coaches. That's context just for people. Okay, now we covered what you wanted to keep the same. Let's go to what did you want to change and what were you highlighting to those players that was going to be a little bit different?
I wouldn't use the word change because I wasn't trying to go against anything, Carly. It was more of me being true to myself and the way that I've been brought up and the different people I've worked for. And for Billy Donovan, Larry Shyatt, Allen Edwards, especially that tree that kind of run of my first 7 years in coaching was, and really 8 out of 9 years, is the level of intensity. And that doesn't mean going at players intensely, the level of intensity to the detail. It was a lot of one of my favorite quotes, and I use it a lot, is the Abraham Lincoln, "If you give me 6 hours to chop down a tree, I'd spend the first four sharpening the axe." Like that level of detail. Like I remember staff meetings where Shiat had it every section of practice, what each assistant was supposed to be watching. That was the level. So not just the practice plan, what are you watching? Allen Edwards had this level of intensity about the culture and about these culture classes that we would have. And these are things that like I wanted to steal for years now, of things that we were going to build this program on, that set, certainly would feel new to a lot of the players. Not that we weren't intense before, but ratchet up more to what I know and I'm accustomed to.
Let's give some more context then. Your dad, Mark, of course, ESPN announcer, former coach, again, one of the first people after I presented at the first Florida clinic to come up to me and speak to what I was saying as saying, "Wow, that's common sense, but we didn't think that way before." And it was just a wonderful conversation. So you've had a great role model, obviously, in him, but your mom is a legend. An absolute legend in college coaching and coaching in general at the University of Florida. I think it was 22 something insane NCAA tournaments or something like that, but you can give us context for that. But you come from a coach's family. So talk to us about that and talk to us about some of the influences both of them had on your development as a coach as well.
We would have family conversations at the dinner table, and it wouldn't be like, "How is your homework going?" It would be, "Hey, how would you attack a 1-3-1?" If it was with my dad, or if it was with my mom, it would be, "If you had to discipline this player that was late to a meeting, how would you handle it?" So we've been talking that way forever. When I call them in the mornings on my way to work most days, it starts with what's going on with our grandkids. And then the second question is what's going on with the team. And so I've got to give them the updates or whatever. I think so much of this job is problem solving. And there's certainly two people that I lean on their wisdom a lot for problem solving. It was actually part of the vision I have had for years of developing and putting together a staff. I think I'm very impressed when young head coaches include an older, established, maybe former head coach on their staff. When they are humble enough to bring wisdom to their staff and to say, "I don't have all the answers. I don't know it all." I've always admired that. But I didn't necessarily think that was going to fit me, because these are conversations I'm already having every single day with the people that I think are extremely accomplished and brilliant in my own family. And so for me, the staff was more about energy and intelligence. And that if we had a staff that was young and vibrant and bold and energetic and really smart, really brilliant, like that part to me is really important, that, and then just willing, like that mixed with the nuggets I'm getting on the side. In hindsight, we'll see when it's all said and done, but that's the vision of what I always wanted to put together and have been fortunate enough to do.
Well, it's a beautiful way to grow up if you love basketball or you love sport or you love coaching. There's no doubt about that. So that's awesome to hear. And you referenced kind of meeting with your staff after you've got the job. Did you have to go through much staffing in terms of your first year as a head coach?
So we were fortunate enough to be able to create a fourth full-time assistant job, which we hadn't had before. And we had a grad assistant in Walker Martin, who, like a former camp counselor, if you know what I mean by that personality, a get it done, whatever the task is, person, and no job is beneath them. And so we were able to hire him on full staff. The other two assistants both wanted to stay, and I wanted them to stay. So that ended up being an unbelievable fit in Charity Brown and Sally Higgins. And then I had to find one more. And did some dirt digging, looked at under some different rocks. But when I joined Christy Curry's staff 4 years ago, our starting point guard was Hannah Barber, who's from Homewood, which is right across the street from Samford's campus. And I told Hannah that year, it was her junior year, she just got in the starting job at the point, I told her that year that whenever I got my first head job, she would be my first hire. Now, it happened a lot faster than I thought it would. And we were both a lot younger than I thought we would be when this conversation happened. And the irony of that one was a year before I had helped convince Hannah to go take an assistant job at Valdosta State for, I didn't take much convincing because the head coach there, Chandler Merkerson, is one of my best friends in the business and brilliant. Like she is going to crush it. Like you should have her on. She is awesome. But I had just convinced her to go take this job. And then 12 months later, I had to call the two of them to be like, I've got to bring her over here. So that was the only new addition, but it's been great.
It's a very cool story. And of course, Hannah reached out to me to tell me I got to have you on the podcast. And of course, I connected her and said, actually, Matt and I know each other. So that was, you were on my list, as I told you before we got on here, but I was going to wait till the end of the season. But she said you'd do it now. And for coaches that are listening now, I also presented to Matt that we're going to do one now and we're going to do one at the end of the season. So first year head coach before the season, first year head coach at the end of the season. So thank you for agreeing to do that.
Absolutely. I will tell you, I was telling the staff, they were asking me who I'm going to be on, and I was explaining to some of them. And I said, and I just started rattling off things that I've done and they've seen me do in an assistant role and now as a head coach. And I've said, the decision making shooting, yeah, that's his. The live finishes at the rim, yeah, that's his. When I stop practicing, I say, recreate to the point of, yeah, that's his. And I just start rattling off this stuff. And I was like, I just watched him present and thought, yeah, I'm stealing that. I'm stealing that. I'm stealing that. And every single time, I just thought it was brilliant coaching. I thought I'm obsessed with the pedagogy and the getting people to understand and what gets it to click, what's sticky, what has staying power, what's motivational, all that stuff. And I thought a lot of it is just really brilliant stuff.
Oh, I appreciate you saying that. I appreciate the support through the years as well. And I'm grateful it's helping you. And I'm grateful you're educating that next generation that doesn't even necessarily know where some of this stuff comes from. And that's a beautiful thing as well. So I do appreciate that. But let's get back into the program because one thing I know that's one of your guiding principles is the hedgehog principle. So talk to us a little bit about that and how that influences kind of your program as you see it going forward.
Yeah, so Jim Collins, the author of Good to Great, one of my favorite books is Beyond Entrepreneurship 2.0. I've given it away to people. I've suggested it. Is he has this idea that the most successful companies, they understand that there's this theory between the fox and the hedgehog. The fox is the cunning, clever, knows everything, has a million different moves. It's witty. It tries different tactics to attack. The hedgehog has one principle. One thing it does really well, it balls up. That's it. That's what it does. It doesn't have a second move. As much as the fox tries its different maneuvers and its clever tactics and everything, it can never defeat the hedgehog because the hedgehog stays true to its one principle. And so for us, because I've been thinking this way for years, I talked to the staff about that. Okay, what's going to be our hedgehog principle? We can't be great at everything. We can't even be good at a lot of things. What are we gonna say? This is our stamp. This is who we are. We are gonna own this space. And then once you know that, then it go he says that it shifts to a giant flywheel, is how he describes it, where it's this giant flywheel that's so big that you could push and push for hours and you might move it several inches. But if you continue to push, metaphorically, and you push, it you might push for days and eventually you get that one full turn. And then you push and you push and you get another one. And then eventually you don't know when, but eventually it catches and momentum takes over and it starts spinning like crazy. And people will say, wow, that thing is flying. That thing is rolling. Like, how did you get it going? And they don't see all the pushes that got it to that point. So if that's what great companies do, then that's what we're gonna do. And for us, our hedgehog principle is development. Now, you got to be true to who you are. And I'm obsessed with development, both for myself and for others. That's why clinics, reading, podcasts, all of it. I even talked about it in our staff retreat. One of the roles and responsibilities for the staff was to learn and share, that you are responsible for learning new items this year and sharing them with the staff. So I personally believe in development. It also has to fit the culture around you. And Samford's a high academic school that is also faith-based. So you got all these people on campus that are obsessed with growth and development, both from a spiritual standpoint and from an academic standpoint. And so it surrounds us all the time. And then obviously there's the basketball development side to it as well. But that's what we want to own, is pouring into young women to develop them to be successful on and off the court while putting ourselves in a position to compete for championships. That is our mission. We talk about it all the time because you can't understand all the little things you're doing if you don't see where the ship is heading. If you don't see the big picture, then you're going rudderless.
I love it. I love the application of that. And the Jim Collins book obviously was a big influence on a lot of people, but applying the concept is the hard part. Making it practical is the hard part. And you've obviously done that. And what does that look like kind of day to day in your program then, in terms of emphasized development as your principal?
So during the day, our staff has several different meetings with players. One, our point guards have an extra film session every week with the two assistants that one, Hannah was the point guard at Alabama. Charity Brown was the point guard at Samford for 4 years and is the all-time assist leader at Samford. And then me as their head coach. So our point guards in the program have a film session, extra film session every week with the head coach and the two stud point guard assistants working on whether it be the way they set up ball screens or vision or reads, just little ways to pour into our key decision maker on the floor. Every one of our players has a session every week at minimum with our assistant, Sally Higgins, who is finishing her sports psychology degree. So we have a two for one on staff that is a sports psychologist, basically, and assistant coach. So many, I've been around sports psychologists, and they'll sit in the stands and take their notes. She gets to go on the floor and apply lessons to them. She gets to take, again, you talk about the practical and implementing it. She gets to implement it with them. So they have sessions with her. So they're developing on their mental skills, their mental training, whether that be for mental health purposes and well-being, or whether that be training the way that they come to the floor and what mentality are they in on the floor? What's their mentality after a mistake? We've got a culture class where we're developing on our values and our understanding of what matters in our program. Our players ask for extra individuals with our assistants every single day. It's hard for me to schedule staff meetings because they're usually going to the court with players. And then when they come to the floor, they do their stretching with the strength coach. And I try not to have the same rhythm to practice. For instance, today we've got workouts, and as soon as they're done, we're going to huddle and kind of talk before we get into stuff. But what we've been doing to this point in the fall is when they finish stretching, immediately the assistants are grabbing a set of players and just hopping on the floor in individuals, just immediately kickstarting their brains into ready to play and getting better. Like it sets a tone so that it's already priming their brains for this is what's to come, as opposed to a coach talking for way too long about stuff that they don't care about to make myself feel better, is right into it. And then, okay, let's huddle. Here's the plan today. Let's go get after it. So it's one of those things. Those are some of the examples, but because everybody understands the mission and everybody understands the principle, it just permeates throughout.
I love it. Way to keep everyone on the same mission. And you said something there that I want to jump on. Not having the same pace, not having the same routine, not having the same practice, so to speak. Talk to us about why.
This is your line. So, for those that don't know, the first time I saw you at the clinic, this was your opening line. When in a game do you take the same shot from the same spot uncontested 10 times in a row? Never. But we all train that way. We all do block training and catch and shoot, make 10 from this spot or whatever it might be. But the game's not played that way. Now, I do think there's an element to grooving your mechanics, especially if you're having to work on some certain element of your shot. Absolutely. But even then, you can mechanic it to death. The second you get into live decision making, you're going to revert to old habits. As far as training practice, if you don't mind, I'm going to go on another tangent.
Please.
Sports psychologist friend Tiffany Jones, who has worked with our program here, she worked with my mom's program back at Florida. She gave me a book to read. And in the book, there was this study done on a soccer team where they took half the players before a training session and half did a like mental stress test on paper. The other half watched a boring like NASA documentary. They went to the field, they practiced, and they graded out which group was better with their decision making live on the field. Which group do you think would have been better with their decision making?
The more relaxed group.
The more relaxed group, the boring NASA documentary performed better. Okay. So, round two of the study, they take them and same setup, half mental stress test, half boring documentary. And this time they had them in a lab and they were able to actually set up decision making and grade it. So, in the lab, who performs better?
I'm guessing the opposite group.
It was again the group that did the boring
Oh, really?
documentary.
Okay.
Okay, so now they decided, okay, so they're making better decisions on the field. They're making better decisions in a controlled environment. Is it because they're seeing it better? So, last version, same setup, and they had them in a VR setup where they're making first person decision making choices, but there's cameras pointed at their eyeballs tracking how fast they're moving and seeing their teammates and tracking the ball and defenders. Which group's eyeballs moved faster and tracked faster?
Relaxed group.
Trick question. They were both the same.
Oh, really?
So both groups are seeing it at the same speed, but the relaxed group is processing it faster. So I'm reading this chapter and I'm thinking, okay, so I got to get them to relax. I got to get them not to stress out, not to freak out. Like, how? But what is fascinating is the book then goes into a professional soccer team that took this information and said, if they're going to, it's a guarantee in the game, they're going to get stressed. And it's a guarantee in the game, they're going to have to make stress decision making. Then we sure as heck better train them that way. And that to me, to tie it all back together, is the trick. Is if we're, the decisions, if we're never going to take the same shot in a row from the same spot 10 times in a row, uncontested, and we're never going to be totally relaxed and fine because the opponent's always going to put stress on us. Then we need to train that way. We need to be adaptable in uncomfortable situations and try to put ourselves in those positions.
So that checks with me, this concept of obviously representative practice environments. And that's the thing. And the challenge with that, which I know, and that's what this study to me connects for me a little bit, is that mindset cannot be imitated unless it's in a representative environment, right? Like, as much as we put them in three-man weave and we put a time pressure on, and if you drop the pass, you got to start it again and again. That's not representative of playing against an opponent and struggling against an opponent and having to figure out a solution to persevere versus an opponent. And that does connect for me in that sense. So talking about that then, one of the biggest struggles, to go on a tangent for you a little bit, I know this, and I've done this with really high-level players through my relationship now with the NBA and Nike, is to put really high-level players in these CLA or these games approach environments where they fail way more than they were used to before doing these on-air block drills. And they really do struggle with that aspect of it. So the question to you then is, now knowing this and the research you shared with us, what are some ways that we can help them be more comfortable with the struggle and to be able to develop that coping mechanism and that mindset to be able to move forward, knowing that they're going to struggle more?
Yeah, I think it starts with your language and your values, right? Every single night at the dinner table with my kids, we ask them a checklist from their school day. What was something you learned or worked on? What was a way that you were a good listener or helper? What was the time you had fun with a friend specifically? So, relationship, community building. And then, what was a time that you experienced struggle or challenge or something difficult today? And they have a hard time coming up with an answer for number four because they're 8 and 5, and so everything's fun. But when they do have an answer for the challenging thing, my wife and I get really geeked about it and really excited, and like they see that we're excited that they had struggle. And so I think when you value it and you add language to it, so I talked about earlier in our conversation the staff outing to lunch the day of the job, and players are trying to go in the portal. The whole staff energy at lunch just flatlined. Conversation died. And I turned to them and I said, whoa, you all thought this was going to be easy? You all thought we were just going to win championships without the work? No, this is great. Of course it's hard. Bring it on. Come on. This is what we signed up for. We signed up for hard. Let's go. And so I think when that's the language and the attitude that you have, then it hopefully shifts the paradigm, right? The way that they see it as an opportunity. Like, I'm struggling. Yes. And it's not easy because, right, you're fighting human nature. Like, you're talking about being excited about when you're uncomfortable, scared, nervous, anxious, worried. Like, that stuff freaks us out. But understanding that emotions and feelings aren't facts, they're signs, they're signal posts. Okay, I'm feeling frustrated or overwhelmed. What's that tell you? Why? A lot of question asking. But if you were training a high-level athlete and they were going through this and struggling despite your enthusiasm and they're getting very frustrated, I think it comes back to I think about Doc Rivers. If you want to know what makes a player tick, you find out what makes them talk and listen. And I think I would go to question asking of, where are you trying to get to? What are you trying to do? You don't think there's going to be struggle along that path? You don't think that this skill work that we're working on, maybe it's preparing you for better decision making on the court, but you don't think that this is preparing you for when the opposing team in the playoffs wins the first two games and you're down 2-0 and you know it's do or die, or you're down 3-1 and you know it's do or die? You don't think this is preparing you for that moment of uncomfortable? What about you go to overtime in a big game, and the opposing team goes on a 7-0 run like that to open overtime? The way you handle these drills, the way that you handle this practice session or whatever it might be, you're just building the strong habits. Why we read every day, you are building the mental capacity and the emotional capacity to handle these moments. You might come up short, but every time you come up short, you're again building and strengthening those muscles.
So obviously I love all this and I'm fascinated by all this, and clearly you've thought stuff through. You've been through a lot of different environments as well, which is beautiful. You've seen a lot of different environments and a lot of different coaches and obviously incredibly successful coaches.
Hey coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Now let's get into the tactical side of things. So, what is Matt going to do on offense this year? And Carly was an offensive specialist, if I'm correct in my knowledge of her a little bit.
Correct.
She was really good offensively.
So what she was really good at was manipulating matchups and strengths and weaknesses, and I hope to continue doing that. For me, we had a discussion around specifically offensively. We'll just talk about that side of the ball for a second, just because you brought it up, that we had a discussion around, do we fit the offense to the players? Do you implement a system? Do you, what do you? And my takeaway and opinion was, I can't pretend to do something or know something that I don't. So I know Coach Donovan's motion ball screen offense like the back of my hand because I watched it every single day for 2 years, keeping my mouth shut, observing, learning, growing with him and Mark Dagnold and John Pelfrey and these absurdly good coaches putting it together. And then I go to Wyoming, and with Shiat, we talked through it, but Shiat wanted to do a more watered down version so that we could focus more energy on defense. We won a lot of games doing it. When Allen Edwards got the head job, he said, show me the motion ball screen again. So I show him with all the options and wrinkles and everything. And we go through it and he said, okay, you're going to put that in. So we put it in and we upped our pace of play to number one in the Mountain West. We go to top three in scoring and win 20 games back-to-back seasons. So that's going to be part of it, but it's not going to be the only thing, because when I went away for a year to Little Rock, I got hired back to Wyoming. And that year we had 12 freshmen and sophomores and we were struggling. We were making young mistakes. We were getting beat by bigger, stronger, more athletic players. And our offense just was not working. And I don't even remember how the conversation happened, but Alan and I are talking and we brought up a true traditional off the ball motion screening, complete randomized down screen bash. We had done it at Transylvania with Brian Lane, where I played, and we talked through it. What might it look like? And so what we did was we did about 2 weeks of a series of practice where there was a group working on finishing at one main basket, a group working on shooting at one main basket, and I had the third. And we started from ground level. When I say ground level, I'm talking about a wide pin and had them learn to say, hey, come get me. Hey, I got you. And go set it. That was it. And then I'd throw it to them. They'd throw it back and they'd talk again. We call it screen talking. And they'd talk through it. Okay, now let's talk through what happens on a curl. Come on. Hey, come get me. Come here. Hey, I'm curling. So I'm curling. All right, I'm popping. Pop, pop. And now they're on the same page. And you build it up piece by piece. And then went to two of them and me, so that I could help them control it, of random motion screening, talking, going through it. And what ended up happening was 2 weeks later, we put it in and we full blown run it. And this is towards the end of the year. We end up getting hot and we end up winning more games out of the seed we were in the Mountain West tournament than any team in the history of the Mountain West tournament. We caught fire. We barely lost to Utah State and Sam Merrill, who's been in the NBA now for however many years. And so I've seen it work and I did it as a player. And so what I love most about doing the true random motion, not that I don't think we'll do 30 possessions of it a game, but it makes you a significantly better set executor. Because if you can not call the slip and naturally do it based off the read, then you really have something special in your set execution. And so I'm hoping that as we continue the off the ball screening development, that that's something that will make us also a better set execution team.
Absolutely. And it sounds like a good way to play as well. And you referenced some of the grind of coaching and not being easy. I was just thinking back as you were talking there going, okay, it's one thing to install the offense. How about doing like 13 straight Zooms and basically saying the same thing? And thinking about that in coaching, that people don't appreciate that. That's one of those hard things, right? Is like, you're constantly saying the same things. And I know in my profession a little bit what I'm doing now, I'm saying the same things all the time, but finding different ways to say it is part of the fun. And I imagine that if I listened to all those Zooms, you'd be saying the same thing, but saying it a little bit differently.
Yeah, I almost feel, again, I'm just obsessed with learning from different people, but I almost feel like a stand-up comedian. I've heard different comedians be interviewed and talk about, you have your material, but you sense the body language, the buy-in, the energy of the crowd. So I know what I want to say, but based off of the response, the head nod, the laugh, the smile, whatever it might be, like, do I have them or do I not? And so, yeah, it's a fun job for sure.
So fun. Take us through the defense a little bit, and the Shiat tree can all defend.
That's what you can expect. It'll be Shiat's system. It's what I know, to the point where we even did the ropes talk this summer and we'll bring him back out. I don't know if you've done it for your audience or not.
I haven't, but I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
But literally pulling ropes from player to show the defender where their positioning needs to be on the floor at any given time. It's a no middle force baseline step up seal down, but the defense, so it'll be position based and habit based of, if we're in position and we rotate correctly, we can be really good defensively. It does not matter your personnel. If you're in position and you rotate correctly, you can be good. Now, if you have elite personnel, you could be great. If you have an elite mindset, you could be great. So to me, what I'm hoping we create is this is Shite's culture was an acronym called ADU, ADU, aggressive, disciplined, unselfish. And I've explained to everybody that this is going to be our definition of toughness. We are going to define toughness with aggressive, disciplined, unselfish. And so if we can have the discipline of positioning and then have the aggressiveness with our handsiness, our physicality, our communication, and then unselfishness, putting your body on the line. Shiites, Florida, Wyoming, everywhere, Clemson, everywhere teams have always been phenomenal charge teams. I'm hoping that's a calling card of ours. I told the players and our staff that we want to lead the league in three statistics defensively: deflections, charges taken, and fouling. Until they start to call them all, I think the game has always favored the more aggressive team. Now, there's certainly levels to fouling. Like, I don't want to lead the league in free throw attempts given up. I don't want to foul every single time a player starts to drive us in, so we hand check them with two hands. But I want to lead in fouling, trying to go make a play on the ball or flicking at it or bumping a cutter or attempting charges that end up being blocks, but we tried. Like, those are the great ones, the unselfish, aggressive, disciplined ones.
I love it. It's going to be fun to watch, obviously, your team, especially with coaches connecting this podcast to watching your first year. It's going to be a lot of fun. What is something so far in these first few months that maybe has surprised you, maybe something that's taken up more of your time or something you didn't realize was going to be such a big part of your job? And of course, the era of college basketball we know is different. So we know the portal, the NIL, all that stuff. But maybe beyond that, what is something that's challenged you in a way that you didn't realize maybe it would?
That's a good question. I like that. I think one, there's several that pop into my mind. One that jumps out at me is I knew in this role there would be a lot more decision making, right? What I don't think I was prepared for was every single problem, question, whatever that any staff member or player brings you. It could be, hey, 2 + 2 = 4, but I just want to make sure you're okay with that. It could be basic. But for that person to feel the need to come to the head coach, for them, they feel like it's one of the most important items on their plate. I think early on, not that I was demeaning or belittling, but I might have kind of hand waved some of the questions and oh, that's no big deal. I don't really care. But I genuinely meant that it's okay. Whatever you choose is fine. I don't care. But how it came across to them for someone who's this is my most important thing I want to go to the head coach with was wow, he doesn't have the same level of interest. So, learning that if they come to you, they're coming to you for a reason would be one of them. I would say another one, along with the constant decision making and work, is I say this in my head, in my own kind of mantra is if you want what others don't, you got to do what others won't. Right. And so, just constantly, what more can we do? What are we not thinking of? And just that workload, when you start to think that way, can become daunting. I did tell the staff one time we were in July recruiting and we had our board broken up into spicy, medium, mild, and who we're going after. And I told them, okay, we're 4 months, 3 months in as a staff. I don't think they're going to get rid of us. But if they were to come in and say, if you didn't get one of these kids on your spicy list, you're all fired. Again, I'm not saying this from a threatening standpoint. I'm saying if they were to say that to us, where would your mind go? What would you come up with? What would you do? What's the stone that we haven't turned over that you would turn over? What's the creative idea? There's got to be something out there that we're not thinking of. But if we had that sense of urgency, we would come up with the fresh idea, the new idea, the what could we do? Which usually involves doing more. And at the time we were in Louisville and we ended up, this is the idea of Hanna-Barber. And so the next morning we get up at 5 a.m. We go drive 2 hours north to another tournament in Indy to go watch one of our top kids play. Then hop in the car, drive 2 hours down to Cincinnati to watch the other kid play, to drive 2 hours back to Louisville to pick up our cars and drive the 5 hours back to Birmingham. So 11 hours of driving that day. We got both of them. So,
A little extra effort sometimes. And did you let them know that you were doing all that? Is that part of it?
After the fact, because we couldn't contact them on a recruiting weekend. Because it was spur of the moment. That weekend, we had sent like one person up and then nobody, and then one person up. And that day, we did three of us city hopped.
Great perspective on what coaching actually is. At least we think that you're just sitting around figuring out X's and O's all the time. It's that part as well. Take us into the first meeting with the players. What are obviously you've covered the hedgehog principle. I assume that's shining through. What are some other talking points for a first-year head coach in that first meeting with players?
Our first meeting with the players, certainly post all the Zooms, everybody's committed. The first one was actually at the house. This was an important part for me. It helps having a wife that's on board with it. But anytime we have official visits, we try to have them over to the house with the whole team for a meal. And our first team meeting was at the house for a meal. Again, coming back to the relationship piece, this was a big Wyoming piece. We did this a lot with both Larry Scheid and Allen Edwards. And so we bring the team over. They play with my kids. They're playing, having fun. We have dinner, play some games, and then we got down to business. And in that very first meeting, we passed out our culture doc to set the tone from the very beginning. This is what we're about. This is what we value. These are the words and the language of our program. And we set them up for clarity precedes accountability. So this is. These are the standards. These are what are non-negotiable, which we're always putting the team first. No whining, no complaining, no excuses, and over-communicate. And if you do those three things, we could probably figure it out. And so we left rules for the fall, but that first meeting in June wanted them to understand these standards are non-negotiable. And so, like, we have a group text. When a text comes through, everybody must like the text or impression it so that we know you saw it. And so the first practice, sure enough, about half the team liked it. And so this is a fun debate because I work in a hallway with a lot of really successful head coaches. And so I'm talking to our volleyball coach and I'm talking to my mom about handling, they didn't meet the standard. I've got to hold them to the standard. And my mom's advice was the punishment needs to fit the crime. So don't run them. The volleyball coach's suggestion, Keeler, he said, it's a chance for you to show them grace and to show them that you're going to be an empathetic leader. And I did not take either of their advice. So what we did was we did a really hard basketball drill, one that we've done over the years that it basically makes them run, but with basketball, without you're not running them or putting them on the line. And so it was interesting because I ended up talking to both of them afterwards for guidance. And did we handle it okay? Was I too much? Did I fly off the handle? And they asked me how I presented it. And I said, I simply told them, we didn't meet the standard of expectation. I'm not mad, but my job is to hold you to that standard. And this will be the consequence. And we did it. And they said, giving out the punishment without an emotional attachment was the trick. That they understood that you weren't mad at them. You expect more of them. So I thought that was good guidance. But that was week one.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great example of, lack of a better word, modern leadership as well, in the sense that, again, traditionally we just run them, right? And that would solve the problem, apparently. But we know that running doesn't solve the problem. So it's like, how can you connect them to the fact that they didn't meet your standard and we need to do better because we want to do better? That type of mentality that comes with it. So I love that. Thanks for sharing that example. My follow-up to all of this then is, what are you doing as a coach now to be able to check in with your players to make sure that you're on track with your culture, with the things that you're trying to build? What are some ways that you can check in because you haven't played a game yet? So trying to figure out if you're on the right track as a first-year head coach is one of those kind of insecurities that exist because you haven't played a game yet. And the game will tell you ultimately where you're at. But in that process, what are you doing?
Boy, that's interesting because that's constantly on my mind, but I don't know that I've thought of it as a strategy. So we have our workouts that we're doing, we have our culture class that we're doing. And so those are the moments where we're teaching all this. But I'm telling you already, like 10 times I've grabbed a player or a staff member. And what'd you think of that? How's that? It's probably insecure on me, but I think there's a
I'd
level
say
of
natural, not insecure at all. Natural.
But also, I think I'm so hardwired for connection that I'm not doing it from a place. I'm not doing it insincerely. I think they feel the sincerity of the question. And I do ask, what can we do better? What do you like? What's different? So, whether that be after a workout, getting one-on-one with a player, rebounding for a player, casual conversation. They certainly stop by our offices all the time, chance to chat with them. And yeah, I think for me, especially moving for so many of these players, they've seen me in one light. Now they're seeing me in another one, is trying to empower their ownership. So I'm a huge believer in, I think leadership amongst players is incredibly overused as a term and as a strategy. They can barely lead themselves, let alone lead others. And when you have one, it's phenomenal. And when you don't, all you're doing is whining and complaining as a coach about if we just had leaders. But you don't need leaders to have owners. And so I think checking with them on, are they understanding? Are they buying in? What don't you get? What's confusing? That's allowing them the opportunity to find ownership. Tony Poole, who is with us at Wyoming, is now the head coach at North Alabama, really successful. And he took the book Extreme Ownership as his culture book. And so I think that has a lot of those elements that I really like as well.
I like that answer. To, I guess the part that all connects too is like you're playing basketball in practice. I know that without having ever seen it. So to somewhat, you're testing it a little bit every day that you practice and you play some type of version of basketball to see if the culture is shining through and if the tactics are shining through. Because ultimately, I think most coaches see it this way. Your practice and the way they practice and the way they interact in practice will reflect the culture that you're building off the court, on the court. And that's got to be a big part of it as well. So, what are some things that you're doing to evaluate your practices right now?
So I talk about sharpening the axe. We meet as a staff a lot. It would drive my mom nuts. She would hate to be on my staff. She's more of an efficient get in, get out. I'm more of a spend time together debating. We debated a drive around from the slot, or a drive from the wing, or a drive from the corner, or a drive from the top, the different angles, going baseline or going middle. How do you move around that drive for about 4 hours? And that way, when we go to the players, it's quick and precise, and they know exactly what the letter of the law is because we've already debated it for hours. And so I think part of the evaluation is debriefing, is feedback with the staff. What did you like? What did you not? We had one workout in the summer. I remember we came back after the workout. We came back to my office and immediately I said that was awful. That was one of the worst practices, workouts I've ever been a part of. It just, the lessons didn't click, the flow didn't click. And it wasn't the good chaos like we think about creating the uncomfortable chaos of a game and adversity, because it wasn't intentional adversity. It was just, they just weren't receiving the information. And I have a staff that I really trust. And so we were able to discuss it, hash it out, go back to the drawing board, and sure enough, make it so much better the next time.
So Matt, obviously you've been an assistant for a while, you've had all these experiences. You never know when the opportunity is going to come, whether it's in-house or out of house. So what's some advice to coaches who are maybe in similar positions about just being ready for a potential opportunity, say an AD says, "Hey, come and interview," that type of thing.
One of my friends in the business who was an assistant AD in North Florida talked about, you got to know why you, why now, why not them? What does that pitch look like? And how would you present it? And then every year, are you updating it? And he told me about how they reached out for a head coaching candidate. And the head coach said, they said, we need your resume. And the head coach said, yeah, I'll get it to you. And then got it to him 2 days later, off the table. They didn't even consider him, because they knew he wasn't ready. And so the idea of, we tell our players all the time, be ready so you don't have to get ready. Well, it'd be the same thing. And I have had my marketing plan for our program, our offense, our defense, our jobs and responsibilities for staff, donor ideas, future recruit list, All of that to me, does it take time? Yes. Does it take so much time that you're taking away from your task and your job? No. But just a little bit of intentionality, focused energy of preparation. And so, sure enough, the way it went down for me here is, and I won't go through the whole story, but I had an interview for another head coaching job 10 days before I got the opportunity to interview here. And because I was already ready and had everything lined up, that when my number got called here, it's no different than the player off the bench. Are you ready when your number gets called? And the way it shook out, I like to think I was. We'll see when it's all said and done. But man, I remember Coach Shiat, he had up in the bookshelf, he had binders to each category. And they were in orange and blue because they were when he was an assistant at Florida. And they were every single element of the program that he had ready to go for when an interview came calling. He showed it to the staff, like, this is how I was ready. And I think you can never, you'd rather have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
Incredible advice. Great advice for coaches looking for that potential next opportunity. And of course, you've got your opportunity. So talk to us quickly about Samford as we wrap up.
I think having a school where there are sincere, significant relationships across the campus, across the athletic department. Our volleyball coach here started his career as a student assistant for my mom at Florida. Our SWA was recruited out of high school. She went on to play at Indiana, but was recruited by my mom when she was an assistant at Kentucky. Our athletic director and my dad go way back to when they were like little kids growing up in Kentucky. So there's all these connections, relationship-wise, which certainly it's who you know, not what you know. I'm sure it has a lot to do with how I ended up in this position, but the relationships are deep. And it's that way for our players amongst the other sports across campus. And then it's you have these people that you trust, and then you have a campus of high values between the faith and Christianity and the academics, the professional success. Samford has a rate of 97% of placing their graduates in either grad school or a job in the area they studied. That's an absurd statistic. So when you have this collection of people that share these values and share these bonds, it just makes it such a unique place. And then you have a president who is trying to grow it. Like trying to grow enrollment, trying to grow facilities, trying to grow the athletic department and the interest in athletics. It makes it a really cool, fun spot. And it helps that my wife is a super successful second grade teacher of the year. Kids are happy. So life's good. No complaints here.
Life's good for us as well, Matt. Thanks to you sharing all this and being so open and connecting with us in your first head coaching job before the season starts. And as I said, coaches, I can't wait to follow Matt throughout the year and his program and connect with him at the end of the season and see what worked, what didn't work, and maybe some of the advice that you would give for first year head coaches after experiencing it as well. Thanks for your open-mindedness and thanks for sharing the game with us.
I appreciate you having me. Our friendship goes way back. Anytime you want.